I'm here in Horsleap, County Westmeath, and talking to John Gorman. John, a very interesting story surrounding your life, but I want to get to the very start first. I want to talk to you about your background. Where are you from originally?
I was reared and schooled in Castle Pollard, and it was a tough life in those days. Young lads had to do a lot of work, and before I'd go to school in the morning, I'd get 2 milk churns on the donkey's cart, and I'd go about 5 miles, milk 7 cows, and come back and get ready for school.
What, your father had a farm?
No, this was for another man.
Oh, you worked for another
Yeah,
farmer.
yeah.
Yeah. And so at a very young age, though, were you
Well,
up
that would
there?
be
Yeah.
at a very young age, yes. And to this day, I'm trying to figure out, and I can't. I ran away when I was 15 and a half.
From home.
Yes, with above all things, a road show. And if one of my children done that today on me, I'd be petrified. But
Why did you run away from home?
I don't know. To this day, I'm trying to figure out why. But I was, for want of a better word, I was captured and brought back home from a place called Stadone in County Cavan. And I was got something to eat and was put to bed and got a hell of a good lecture. And I never closed my eye that night. And I knew I had a racing bike in the shed outside the back. And I was hoping out of all hope that the wheels weren't flat. So I got up the next morning at 5 o'clock and snuck out of the house and round to the shed, got my bike, and the wheels were hard. So I threw my leg on the bike and I headed for a place called Finney. The song, The Bridge of Finney? And I went into Finney and round and back into Stradone that way, in County Cavan. So the next port call was a place called Rathsherr Bridge. So we were there for a few weeks in Rathsherr Bridge, and a place I used to go every year on my school holidays was I had an aunt in Dunboyne in County Meath, and the next port of call was Dunboyne, and I said to myself, "Well, how am I going to get away with this? Sure, they probably won't notice me." So we landed in Dunboyne anyway, and I was about 15 minutes in Dunboyne when my aunt Olive came down. "Come on, me boy," she said, brought me up to the house. She said, "What do you think you're doing?" So anyway, I was there for 3 or 4 days with her. So she said to me this morning, "Well, now," she always called me Johnny, "Well, now, Johnny, I don't know what you were going to do unless you joined the army." So she put a 10 bob note in my hand, which was an amount of money at that time.
This is about 1958, was it?
It'd be hidden 59, yeah. Yeah, very early 59. And I said, "Okay," so I'll go down and I get the bus. "No," she said, "you won't. I'll bring you down and put you on the bus." So she did. And I got off the bus in Mullingar and went up to Colin Barracks. And this was all new to me now, because at that time in the army there were billets which there would be 15 or 20 people sleeping in. So I was there, and at night I didn't close an eye, I think, because a young lad like that would be a bit scared. So I was up the next morning, bright as a button, shaved and washed and everything, and the orderly sergeant came in, who was a man called Mick Maher, and we stayed friends ever after. Mick is now deceased, sadly. But he let us shout. He says, "Come on, get out of them beds," he said. "Look at this young lad in from the country. And he's up, shaved and washed and all," but he didn't know there was a fear, because this was all new to me,
Yeah.
to bunk in with so many people. So I was in Mullingar anyway, and then I was sent to Athlone to do my basic training. And I went to Athlone, and I made those people in Athlone, such as Paddy Neville, who was a father to hundreds of young soldiers, and Jack Pendergast, who sadly passed away 2 weeks ago at the age of 93. He was our company sergeant in Jadaville, actually. And Jack had a great influence on my life. You know, he was a Tipperary man. And so I'd done my basic training there, and that time it was 6 months, you know, training. And then I was home on holidays, and I heard it on the radio that they were looking for troops to go to the Congo. So I didn't say anything to my mum. I just went back down and cancelled my leave. But at that time, they had two battalions picked, the 32nd and the 33rd. So I was lucky enough. I got out with the, well, I don't know whether you call it lucky or unlucky. I got out with the 35th battalion.
But before you left, yes. How did you fit into the army? Did you think that it was the place for you, or did you think that you know, it was just a job, or
well,
how did you manage at such a young age?
Well, in the very late years, Paddy Neville told me, and Paddy is a Clare man and a very intelligent man. He said to me, when I first saw you, Gorman, I said, how in God's name are we going to make a soldier out of that joke? And he said to me, you turned out one of the best soldiers I've ever seen.
What about education?
Education, if you were a labourer's son, you didn't get education. If you were a shopkeeper's son or a farmer's son or a man of means, then yes, you got education. Morris, unfortunately, I had to educate myself. And I done it on my own. And, you know, I often say to myself, well, if I was capable of doing that, if I did get help, well, where would I be today, or what would I be today? But sadly, that was the case. And I hope it's not still going on today.
How did you get on with the other lads training in Athlone at the time, before you went out?
Well, I really and truly, I suppose, I was a bit of a loner, really. You know, I didn't mix much, ever.
As well as being a loner, were you lonely?
No, I enjoyed the army, and I'd be going out town at night there, and I'd dress up and go off out and then meet the girlfriends and that, and, you know, you'd go to the pictures and that type of life or thing. But I enjoyed the army, and I have to say, I'm, you know, I get invites into the barracks, which I'm very honoured for, and I'm very proud of the army today. When I see them going over to see such places as Chad and these places, and they are so well equipped and so well armed and all of that, and when I look at the DVDs I have there of us going overseas in bull's wool, brown hognail boots, big peak caps, and greatcoats, we used to call them, the overcoats. My God, you know, it's a completely different army. But then, having said that, I always take into consideration the people that were there before me. What kind of life did they have? You know, when we go for our meals, there'd be a big long table with sheets on it, and there'd be a loaf. They used to cut it in four quarters and line them all along the table and put a knob of butter on the top of them. And you just went and you collected your bread and your butter, and you went down then and you sat at the table and you were wondering then what was going to come out of the kitchen. But Wednesday, funny enough, was always a great day in the army. It was stew day. And stew was good in the army, you know.
So the food wasn't exactly the best, but you managed. Okay.
We managed, and you know, it was probably better than what most people had outside. And but the food now in the army, I was often in there at functions, and it's second to none. It's hotel standard.
But now, talking, you were 17.
Yeah.
You wanted to go to the Congo.
Yes.
Why?
I suppose for adventure. You know, I mean, I'd never been outside of Ireland. And I say 90% of our company, I say, was never on a plane, number one. And it was just an adventure, you know, and to be just to be there, to get out there, I was there.
Had you any idea where the Congo was?
Not a clue. Not a clue. Not a clue. The only thing I ever knew about Africa was, in my day, it's probably not going on today, but you brought in a penny for the black babies. And that was all we knew about it. And, you know, but it was a great adventure.
Now, you signed up to go. What year was that?
1961.
And that was with the...
With the 35th Battalion. Yeah. Yeah.
How many of you?
In our company, there was about 160. So when we went into Jadaville, we had only 156. And the rest of them were detached to Elizabethville and Kamina and different places like that.
Was this the second time that Ireland sent troops to the Congo?
Well,
or were they out? Was there?
Well, we started in 1960, mm-hmm. and sending out troops. We had observers out before that, so. Like, this is the 50th anniversary of Ireland sending troops to overseas for the UN. And we had a Swedish interpreter with us. He's now deceased. I met him in Dublin about 3 years ago. A lovely, lovely person. And we also had a Swedish co-pilot and a Norwegian pilot who flew the helicopter into Jadaville with water to us, and the water was stagnant with diesel, so we had to throw it out.
Why were those? But explain to me what were the circumstances behind the Irish troops going out? Why were you going over there in the first place?
Well, it was called the Belgian Congo. And I think at the time that the natives out there were taken up against the Belgians. So we were sent out there to protect them. And, you know, as it so turned out, when we went into Jadaville to protect them, they didn't need protection. The politics behind it, I started a campaign for... recognition or vindication and recognition for my company commander Pat Gwindlin, who was an outstanding man and a good Kerry man like yourself, and the rest of our company, and particularly the deceased members of our company. I have a list of them there, and there's about that I know of about 80 of those people are deceased out of 156. Now I know that the Swedish interpreter is deceased. The Norwegian pilot is deceased, but the other Swedish guy I'm trying to track down, he's still alive.
Okay, but let me bring you back to 1960, when the B platoon were out there.
Yes.
Why were they brought back?
Oh, you mean now B company was in Jadaville?
Yes.
There was also a Swedish company in there with them, and... the Swedish company were the first to withdraw, because they saw if something happened, well then there hadn't a chance, because the only access to Jadaville was a bridge called the Lufira Bridge, and that it was the only access into it and out of it. So the Swedish troops pulled out, and then I was told that on clear radio by a certain gentleman, and he was very honest about it. He said that they got onto headquarters and said that hostility towards them was unbearable. And then they were told to pack up and get out. And at the time, we were dug in around the airport in Elizabethville, and we were told to pack up and get in there.
For what reason? Because you were better trained?
No, I couldn't see any difference between A company and B company. To whatever reasons, if there were reasons, we were the meat in the sandwich.
Why were you put in that situation? Have you any idea?
Well, I would have ideas, but I kept them to myself because I don't want to end up in the High Court.
But for the record, just your own opinion, why were you put in there?
There was reasons behind it, I'd say.
What is the most outstanding reason?
I don't know. I couldn't say it now, to be quite honest, Morris.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't. I hope not.
Yeah.
Because this is the reasons that I'm a man.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there was an incident that took place in Ireland in 1960 in Renmore Barracks in Galway. There was a con man there. He called himself Sir Patrick Murphy. And it was on the 17th of March, actually, St. Patrick's Night, to throw a big function for him. And he stood up sometime during the night and he posed a toast to the Queen of England. No, sorry. He posed a toast to the President of Ireland. And that was fine. So later on during the night, someone stood up and posed a toast to the Queen of England. So our man, our company commander, lost a head. And of course the guards were called in and all at that particular time. And the people who were in the battalion headquarters were also there. So maybe you can read between the lines and see where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
You know.
So there was...
Well, I would always connect that.
Would you?
Yes, most definitely. Most definitely, because human nature being what it is.
And the powers that be.
Yeah.
Pull all the strings.
Pull all the strings. And, you know, if I got into difficulties over somebody and I had a way of getting back at them, I would. You know, so human nature being what it is.
And it was because of that occasion.
That would be my opinion.
Yeah, okay. All right. Now, going back to the situation that you found yourself in. Now, you were 17 and a half, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you were with the 35th Battalion.
That's right.
And you were now pushed in to the front line, so to speak.
Yeah, we were put into Jadaville and... we were there and there was patrols up and down the road by the Katangans every hour on the hour. And Quinlan, being a cute Kerry man, made us dig the trenches at night and just relaxed during the day as if nothing was happening. And, you know, we cursed him, I suppose, but I tell you, he was right. He was right. And... then we were at Mass one morning and three truckloads of gendarmes drove into the camp to take it over while we were at Mass. But John Manahan, thank God, wasn't at Mass and he jumped into the machine gun and fired a few bursts over their heads, so the scarpered. But it was discovered after that there was a garage across the road, and it was discovered that he was tipping them off. He was obviously a mercenary. But I remember the day or the morning Quinlan went over and put him out of it, and we took it over. But he was giving them any information they wanted about our camp. And, you know, that's the way it was. But then... they had the aid of a Fuga jet, which we didn't. We were very badly equipped, really. And I suppose the Vickers and the Bren gun and the Mortar We had only the 60 millimeter mortar, which wasn't very much benefit to us. If we had the bigger mortars, we could hit their barracks then, or hit the town, which I'm sure Pat Quinlan wouldn't have done, because there'd be civilians there. But I'm just saying what we could have done with the right equipment. The Fuga used to come in every morning. He'd come in with the sun and he'd bomb and drive the place with bullets and that. And he'd go on then to Elizabethville and then he'd go to Camina. And he used to land the plane in a place called Calwisi. And the hangar was actually under a mountain. So they actually had two jets, but the UN luckily had one of them grounded in Elizabethville.
Yeah. And how did you survive, I suppose, the coming weeks that after that?
Well, you see, as I said to you, Pat Quinlan, being a huge Kerry man, he dug another set of trenches and he'd moved from one to the other. And when the jets are coming at that evening, we'd be there. And when you come in the morning to get us, we'd be over there. And that's how Quinlan survived. And he was a very intelligent man. And, going back to all those years, I always admired Pat Quinlan for what he'd done in Shatterville.
Right. Do you think that he saved many lives?
All of our lives. We had only, I think, 7 wounded. But I'd say if it wasn't Quinlan, we would have been in a lot of trouble.
Describe the battle as it unfolded.
Well, when it started...
continuous battle.
When it started, you see, that we had great leadership from our platoon commanders to our senior NCOs to our company commander. We just... You wouldn't get better leadership anywhere. That man I'm talking about, Jack Pendergast, was our company sergeant, and he was an iron man, Paddy Neville, Walter Hegarty. We had our Tommy Kelly on the mortar, and Tommy would put a shell through the eye of a needle. He was that good, he was, they used to call him Hawkeye Kelly, and he was... just great bits of stuff to her, absolutely. But sadly to say now, all those people I'm telling you about now are deceased. Bar Paddy Neville, he's not. Paddy is still to come.
Now, on this mission, peacekeeping mission, were the Irish, were you, there was nobody else there backing you up from any other country?
No, we were a company and we were there on our own.
Who were you shooting at?
We were shooting at the gendarmerie and the Belgians, the mercenaries.
And what kind of troops, what kind of people were they? Had you any idea how good were they?
They were much better equipped than we were. And then, of course, they had the aid of the Fuga jet, which was a big plus for them. But I think on one occasion the Fuga was hit with small arms fire, and then he wouldn't come, he'd come in much higher altitude. He wouldn't come in lower as he used to. So he realised, I suppose, that he could be hit. So, there was, it was sad, Maurice, when you think of it. There was over 400 of those people killed, and all for greed, politics. I'm sure to this day they didn't want to be doing it either, but that's just the way it was. They were, as I said, led by the Belgians. And
you said they were mercenaries.
Oh, yes.
Were they natives?
No, they would have been Belgians and French and perhaps maybe even British, I don't know, but there was, I think, 40 of them killed, the mercenaries.
Yes.
Sadly, a lot of the natives were killed.
You said there were 400 killed altogether.
Yeah.
What were the any of the Irish
No,
fall?
thankfully. There was seven wounded.
Sure, yeah, obviously you were great combat fighters then
Well,
at that.
we had great, as I said to you, we had great leadership. Like, I mean, I would safely say that 80% of that company were some of them 16, 17, 18, you know, that type of age. And maybe up as far as 19.
How long were you dug in then?
We were there for 6 days and nights, and our company commander, Pat Quinlan, was, I suppose, sick to the teeth, looking for reinforcements. And he even sent a man out. He posed as a sick man with our doctor, who was Dr. Clune, Joe Clune, into battalion headquarters to stress how urgent this was. And he was told, well, you'll have reinforcements in the morning. But when he got up in the morning and he was told, well, the reinforcements will follow, so they never did. So we were still on our own, you know.
That must have been a terrible setback, disappointment.
Well, it was because we were left in limbo. And when it came to the crunch, then when things were getting bad, the sent reinforcements, but it was much too late. And the reinforcements tried to take the Lufeira Bridge and they failed. And to pull back 6 or 8 miles to bed down for the night and gave the others every opportunity to block the bridge, bring up reinforcements and everything. Where I, in my opinion, I was only a young lad then, but in my opinion, fire should have been kept on that bridge all night. Firepower.
The bridge was it, that was a very strategic
Oh
point.
yes, almost definitely yes. That was the key.
Why? Where was that leading you to?
That was leading you either in or out of Jataville. That was the only access into Jataville.
And it
Was
was very important then to take that.
Yes, it was very important. Well, without taking that, they wouldn't get anywhere, you know. And that was a plus for the other side because they blocked it with heavy machinery, road machinery, and everything that night. And when they came back the next day, then that and the hope. So it was just left too late, Marish, you know.
And who was leading that particular
It was Cameron Johnny Kane was leading that. And you know, if Quinlan got reinforcements when he requested them, it would have been a different story. And he looked to be either taken out or sent in reinforcements.
and the reinforcements came, but they came too late.
They came too
And
much too late.
the
Well, Pat Quinlan was told the ceasefire talks were going well in Elizabethville, and that, well, then naturally he would think that if he didn't agree to a ceasefire, well, then it would throw a damper on the talks in Elizabethville. So part of the conditions were that we would hand in our heavy weapons, such as they were, which we did do, and then there was supposed to be joint patrols by the gendarmerie and ourselves, and this our smaller weapons, such as rifles and that, were to be stored in an Irish, where the Irish were staying. But that didn't really materialise because there was a black minister, I can't think of his name now, came to on the scene, and he walked up to Pat Quinlan. And we didn't know, of course, at the time what he was saying to him, but he told him that he would have to surrender. Right? Now that was completely against everything, the Geneva Convention, against everything. This happened during the ceasefire. And we were all out in the open. Now, had we tried to do anything, we had no bigger weapons other than our rifles. So, I mean, it'd be just slaughter.
What did he do?
Well, he looked for conditions of the surrender. But you see, Morris, how can you surrender during a ceasefire? You know, I mean, it's going against everything.
And you were under the impression, so, that there was a ceasefire in place.
Oh, there was definitely a ceasefire, yes.
And you had come out of cover,
yes,
handed over your
large
weaponry,
yeah,
and you were surrounded by
the gendarmerie and mercenaries, yeah.
And the leader of the gendarme, of the army,
the Minister of the Interior, I think it was,
yeah,
came and he told Pat Quinlan that he would have to surrender. And we were all standing out there in the open.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that to me, if people would look at that as a surrender, well then, you know, they would have to be there to see exactly how it happened.
At that stage, were you fearful for your lives?
Well, that's one of the things that Pat Quinlan looked for, was for our well-being and our safety. You know, because you have to realise there was a lot of those people killed. And we would have been in quite a lot of danger, really, I suppose. If it went wrong, we were just gone. You know.
What happened to you?
We were taken to a camp. We were taken to a hotel first, and we were held there. And then we were taken to a place called Kalwezi. And we were held there then. It was just like a kind of a real prison camp. They had the wires all around it and the whole lot, and the sentries all marching around and that type of thing. So we were just, I suppose, doomed. and you know, I suppose it went through many of their heads, well, are we ever going to see Ireland again? You know, but we did. Thank God, and thanks to Pat Quinlan and the leaders we had.
Well, take me through those days, the circumstances that led to your release.
Well, the UN had prisoners of theirs, so they were trying to set up a prisoner exchange. And I remember we were taken from Kalwezi to Elizabethville by bus. And there were sentries in the bus and on top of the buses. And we arrived in Elizabethville anyway. So whatever went on, the drivers of the bus just came out and got into the bus, turned the buses and back the whole way to Jadaville. You know, so like, I suppose it's easy to say it now, but if that had been foreseen, there could have been roadblocks set up, there could have been many things done, but there weren't. So on the second attempt, the exchange took place.
Right. The first attempt, was there a letdown? Were your troops, including yourself, did you feel that, okay?
Well, I don't know what was said or what went on, but obviously they were probably looking for more than what they were getting or whatever, but we were certainly landed back. We went over the Lough Bridge again, let me tell you. And you know, the ending was good, I suppose, but like, I mean, in fairness, I don't think, in my opinion now, that Pat Quinlan got a fair crack of the whip since Jadaville.
Well, you got over the bridge.
Yeah, back into Jadaville.
All right. It must have been a relief when you got to the other side, released now.
Oh, it was. And I remember we were addressed by General John McKeown in the farmyard, actually. And that's where we were based. And we were rearmed and back into the thick of things again then, because the battle to take the tunnel was on. And some of that footage I showed you, that's what was happening. And that's the type of fire at the type of things that happened, you know. And it's just, I suppose it was a big letdown, really, from the part of the United Nations and the battalion and that. And I feel bitter about it in ways. But when we were in Jadaville, of course, the UN looked for permission for to land planes in Manona Airport, which was a British base, and they were refused. And I think that the Irish government should have put some kind of pressure on those people to allow the planes to be landed.
When you came across and you were told that you had to arm yourselves again,
yes,
and get stuck back in,
yes,
in into this combat,
yes,
were you, I'm sure you were exhausted from your ordeal,
yes,
of being captured and in a prison camp, being thrown back in again, was there fatigue set in, or, you know, were you prepared to go back and fight again?
Well, I suppose at that stage, Morris, you know, it was nothing new to us. We were used to it at this stage. And shots being fired didn't make a bit of difference to us. We were kind of immune to it at this stage. But 36th Battalion coming out, they were coming into the thick of it, in fairness to them as well. And it would have been new to them now.
Yeah.
You know.
What about casualties?
Casualties, well, there was some people killed at the Lefera Bridge that time to try to get through it. And overall, I think there was something like 26 people killed in the Congo, Irish people. And we as UN veterans now, we do memorial peace gardens, and there are 89 names on it, and please God, that's all that will ever be on it.
All close friends of yours?
Yes, colleagues who were killed in the Lebanon, Congo, Cyprus, all over.
Yeah.
There are 89 names there now.
But specifically in that particular incident, trying to take the tunnel, was that a very difficult
task? It was indeed, and the Indians were there. Some of them killed, a good few of them killed, I think, at the tunnel. And it's, you know, but they took it anyway, and the 36th Battalion then took it over. And we flew out of, I remember on our way home, we flew out of Elizabethville.
After how many months?
After 6 months.
6 months.
Yeah. We flew out of Elizabethville, I'll never forget it, in a plane with no seats. We were sitting on the floor of the plane.
Why, they were cargo planes?
They were cargo planes, and we flew out into, from Elizabethville to Leopoldville. And then on our way home to Ireland, which we thought we'd never see again. You know, but God is good, you know, and
yeah,
prayers are good. And we had a great chaplain, and Father Thomas Fagan from Finney, he came from. He was stationed in the Air Corps in Gormanstown. And I suppose when you see the chaplain coming along to the trenches and giving you the last rites, it's a bit, it can be a bit scary, you know. But he did, in fairness, he was a great man. And then the man I mentioned.
When the cargo plane arrived in Elizabethville, what was your brief then?
That was to take us then to Leopoldville.
But what happened?
On our way home.
What happened in, you were there for a while, were you?
We were in Elizabethville for most of the time, the taking of the tunnel, and
hold on, that's where the tunnel
was. Elizabethville.
Yeah. What was this? How long was this tunnel? It was a road tunnel. Is that
it? Was
right?
A road tunnel.
How
it
far?
Wasn't very long. No.
And why was it important?
I don't really know. It was probably a good place to be, I suppose, to for a field of fire and that, you know. And I don't know the reason why they wanted to take the tunnel, because.
But was it a way into Elizabethville? Is that a
it
reason?
It was just a bridge across a road.
Yeah.
A main thoroughfare. and they called it the tunnel, and that was taken by the UN.
Right. Now, there were a lot of people killed.
At the tunnel.
Civilians? In the town itself?
No. There was a good few Indians killed there. We had Indians with us and Gurkhas and that in the Congo.
But was there any civilians shot in the...
Not that I know of, no.
Right. No, what was your brief then when you were inside in Elizabethville? What did you have to do? Were you involved in tidying up and in burying these people, for example?
No. I remember looking at the footage there now, but I remember we just picked them up and put them in trucks, and even was wounded or bandaged and taken off. So...
During the taking of that tunnel, there were quite a number of casualties.
There was, yeah. And a few people were killed there at the tunnel. And
now, these were Indians and...
There was Gurkhas there and Indians and the Irish and the Swedes, you know, and I think there was Ethiopians there with us as well in the Congo. And... you know, the tunnel was finally taken anyway, at a cost.
How long was the battle? How long did it go on for?
I'm not too sure how long the one in Jadaville or in Elizabethville went on for, because it would have been a kind of new to us, because we weren't long out of Jadaville when all this started again, you know. And it was going on for some time. There was trouble in Elizabethville before we came out of Jadaville, you know. Mm.
Pat Quinlan had no orders to go into.
He was told to go into Jadaville, but like he wasn't told he had no written orders as to what he was to do. He was also part of an operation called Mortar, and that man was part of that operation, and he never knew. He wasn't told until 5 minutes before we were attacked in Jadaville. That he was part of this operation. That man was sent into Jadaville with not being told that he was part of this operation. I think that was a disgrace to do that to that man. I think it was a shame. He should have been told. He was there part of an operation that he didn't know about.
So it was quick thinking in his part dig these trenches and to get stuck in.
Yes. Like, I mean, Pat Quinlan was an outstanding man. And I'll always say, till the day I die. And he was a fair man, and he was a very intelligent man, which obviously the whole thing of Jadaville proves, you know.
What else happened in there at that time? I mean, was there any other situation other than the constant firing and attacking?
No, there wasn't. It was just mostly firing and the Fokker jet coming in and that.
Yeah.
You know, but had Quinlan known what he was supposed to have known, it would have meant so much more to him. He would have known the reasons, the cause, everything. But that was all kept from that man. And, I mean, I don't know why it was kept from.
So was it the look of God then that you weren't all killed?
It was
killed?
The look of God, yes. Because if Quinlan had known those things, you know, and I mean, he probably knew more the reason why we were being put in there than we did. But... No, but I think in fairness, the man should have been told, you're part of this operation, Martha. And then, at least, he would have known.
Yeah.
But he didn't. And when you go in there with no orders, what to do, or how to do it, or whatever, and then you're like a fish out of water, really. And only for Quinlan was such an intelligent man, we would have been all in serious trouble. Then there was a journalist came to visit us in Jadaville, or Kalwezi, a fella by the name of John Ross. And Quinlan gave him a letter, mm-hmm. to
post home to his wife.
And I believe the contents of that letter was radio messages, logs, radio logs. And John Ross then, when he went back to the battalion, he said, "I have a letter here from Pat Quinlan to post to his wife." So a certain gentleman said, "Well, give me that letter and I'll make sure it gets tyrant." But it never got tyrant.
Any idea what the content of that letter was?
There was supposed to be radio logs in it, radio messages that Quinlan sent to the battalion headquarters.
Right. So this was all part of the cover-up.
Well, this would have been a great thing for Quinlan to have. Like when we came home to Ireland, if he had those, you could prove what the messages that were sent were.
What were the messages? Any of the messages? Do you know?
I don't, but I know the message that Pat Quinlan got when we were taken hostage in Jadaville was, "Are you abandoning your men?" That was a terrible thing to say to that man, because Pat Quinlan would no more abandon his troops than the man in the moon. He would never do that. Never. You know. And this is the reason I felt all my life so bitter towards the people who done that to Quinlan. Because I waited and waited and waited. And I remember saying to him one evening in the Royal Hotel, "Pat, someday it'll be put straight." And I can see him there smiling at me as much as to say, "John, never a hope." He's dead and in his grave now. Things are put right. And I hope to God some way, somehow, he will know. And the rest of the lads is up there with him. But Quinlan never got a fair crack at the whip. Never. And I waited until the last man that was in the army at the time of Jadaville retired. And then I started my campaign. And thanks to our present minister, Willie O'Dea, because without him, I think I may not have succeeded.
Just tell me that at that time, it was Lamass was in power, the Minister for Defence was Kevin Boland.
Yes.
Was there, did you feel that they didn't do enough or that they weren't helpful?
I mean, you have to realise, you know, that, well, they certainly didn't do enough. Now, when you think of it, I have documents there stating that Eisenhower and Kennedy were involved in this. And, you know, there was a minister out there called Patrice Lumumba who threatened to bring in the Russians. And he was assassinated, cut up and put in a bag because he threatened to bring in the Russians. Now, another shadow over all of this was that Dag Hammarskjöld was flying out. He was the UN Secretary General. He was flying out with his bodyguard, who actually was from Athlone, a man called Frank Ivers. He was only 28 years of old. That plane came down. There's things surrounding that issue as to why did the plane come down. And that case was heard and closed for 50 years and a day.
My God.
But thank God that 50 years and a day is nearly up.
Yeah.
I wrote personally to Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the United Nations. And I asked him, you know, that if the answers to those questions lay anywhere, it was in the UN headquarters. And would he please do something about it?
Did you feel that you were a pawn in a big game?
Yes, correct. Yes, we were. Yes, we were. And I mean, were our own people that put us in there aware of what could have happened?
It's one of the forgotten.
It's something that was never meant to come to light. Never meant to come to light. Because I done this campaign and, you know, people forget. I went round discreetly. I would ask so-and-so, do you remember what happened in Jadaville? No. So I decided then, after going around five or six of them, that, well, I better go at it alone.
Okay, John, tell me about the troops, your companions out there. What happened to them? Some of them ended tragically in their lives.
They did indeed, yes, and it was very sad. And I got during my campaign, there was a family in Donegal who was trying to get in contact with me, but they would have had no problem because my phone numbers were on Midlands 103. But they rang the mayor of Athlone, Austin Berry, who was actually a friend of mine, and looking for my phone number. So Austin didn't give them my phone number, but he gave me theirs. But
Are you one of the few survivors from that time?
Yes.
Did some of these lads take their own lives?
Yes.
Why?
I would love to know why. I would love to know why. There was no counselling at that time. There was no nothing. You just came home, you got your month's leave and your few bob, and you were back in a month's time. And a lot of lads, unfortunately, took their lives. A lot of lads drank themselves to death, and they're still doing it. And it's sad. It's very sad to see that. You know, and I know most of them, and I talk to them. And I ask them why, and they can't tell me. You know?
Is what happened out there specifically?
Well, it would have an awful effect on some of those lads. You know, and it had an effect on me as well. I mean, I attended a psychiatrist for 3 or 4 years. And, you know, but thankfully, I had in my head to do what I'd done. And perhaps that kept me going. Because there's no point in saying I wasn't bitter. Yes, I was bitter for what was done to Pat Quindon and his company. And that thinking of that alone gave me the drive to keep going.
What about being decorated when you came home? Did that happen?
No. There would have been quite a number of people recommended for decoration. There's no doubt about that. And I know some of them, and they have got their documents, and yes, they were recommended. But unfortunately, the medals board, whether a medals board ever sat or not, I don't know, because of Jadaville, they might have just said, well, no, forget it. You know, but yet, when we came out of Jadaville, there was, I think it's 3 or 4 of our company were decorated for their heroism in Elizabethville, but not for Jadaville. You know, and I think that's a shame. And it came out in the study group report that, you know, that Air Company should be honoured, Pat Quindon should be honoured.
Was Pat Quindon honoured?
No, only in this campaign.
Right. But he never got any recognition?
No.
For Jadaville?
No. He reached the rank of colonel, which a lot of young officers do in the army at the present day. But I remember a brigadier general, or a brigadier out of the British Army, read the book Siege at Jadaville. And he said if that man had been in our army, he would have went right to the top, and when he would retire, more than likely be knighted. That was his opinion on Pat Quindon.
Mm-hmm. What about your army life? Did it continue when you came home?
It did. Well, to be quite honest, I went absent for 3 years. A lot of lads did, and a lot of them are still out there in England or wherever. And one particular chap, he was a bit worried about it, so I got that fixed up for him, and he's He's officially discharged now in the last year. And
did you ever rise above the rank of corporal?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I had no interest in it. Because at the time, money would be bad in the army. I had a family career, trying school. So I was doing, as they call them, nixers. You know, which I had to pay, keep a roof over my head.
Make ends meet.
Make ends meet. Educate my family as best I could. That something that I never got. So I done that. Thank God. And thank God all my family done well.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was determined that they wouldn't end up the way I did.
Well, John Gormley, that was an amazing story, and thank you for telling it to me. Thank you.
You're welcome, Morris.